nanohub.org.
Online simulation and more for nanotechnology.
Okay, so today we'll continue. We'll continue our discussion of multi-level synthesis, and to quickly recap and give us a context for where we left off. Okay, so to quickly recap and give us a context for where we left off, we are looking at multi-level optimization. You have a circuit represented as a network, a Boolean network, and each node in the network is, think of it like a super gate. It's a sum of products expression in itself, and you have a network of such nodes. The general strategy we are using for multi-level synthesis is performing iterative transformations on this network to improve it in some sense. And specifically, we were interested in algebraic division, where we treat Boolean expressions, these sum of products expressions inside each of the nodes, as polynomials in real numbers, and divide them or try to find common factors. So to solve the problem of finding common factors across multiple expressions in the different nodes, we proposed a specific concept of kernels and co-kernels, which in a sense cut down the size of the search space when you're looking for common factors. Rather than looking at all possible sub-expressions, the result by Brayton and McMillan just tells us that we need to only look at kernels and co-kernels of the individual expressions and look at, use those kernels and co-kernels in some sense to generate these common factors or common divisors. Okay? So this is the context. This is where we are. And towards the later part of the previous lecture, we also looked at a recursive algorithm for actually generating all the kernels of a given expression, right? All the kernels and co-kernels. And briefly recapping, this is what the algorithm looks like. It's a recursive algorithm, so you call it. It takes advantage of the property that a kernel of an expression is also a kernel of the original expression itself. So therefore, you can recursively call the same kernel generation algorithm on any kernels that you find to discover additional kernels of the expression. And in order to be efficient, we keep impose an ordering on all the variables in the expression, right? Without laws of generality, we can think of it as a lexicographic order. The important thing is whatever order you pick, you process variables only in that order. And as you try to extract these kernels, you do not revisit the same variables, okay, again. So this is what the pseudocode of the algorithm looked like. So you're calling the function kernels with two parameters. J is just an index keeping track of how many variables you have already processed. And G is the expression on which you are trying to compute kernels. So initially, J will be equal to 0. Assuming your variables are 1 to n, J is 0, indicating that you've not processed any of the variables. G will be the original function itself that for which you're trying to compute kernels. And the first thing that this procedure does is checks if the original expression is itself cube-free. It is a trivial kernel for itself. Of course, this is not just in the top-level call, but also at any point in time when you're trying to compute a kernel of any expression at any level in the kernel tree, you look at that expression. If it's cube-free, it's a trivial kernel in itself. So you initialize the set of kernels to G if G is cube-free, otherwise initialize it to the empty set. And then now you process the remaining variables in lexicographic order. And you look for a literal that appears in more than one cube. Why do you do that? Essentially, what you're doing is you're considering each of these variables to be part of the co-kernel that you're extracting out. So when, remember, a co-kernel is a single cube, but a kernel has to be multiple cubes, right? So when you divide the expression by a single literal, when will you get the result to be multiple cubes? Only if the literal appears in more than one cube of the original expression, right? Only then when you extract it out, you'll have multiple terms remaining. So that's why you look at the, use this as a condition for proceeding further. Only if this literal appears in more than one cube, can this literal now be part of a co-kernel, right? So if that is the case, then you have two other possible cases, conditions within that. There is a speed-up technique here that we will, come back to, I think, when we look at the example I'm going to be talking about to illustrate this algorithm. But the important thing to note for now is that once you divide the function, the expression, by the literal that you're processing, li, you make that cube free, meaning if there is any common literal to all its terms, you extract that out and take that expression and make a recursive call to the kernel's function again. Okay? So you keep doing this, and these two lines are just a speed-up technique. The algorithm is still going to be correct if you skip these two lines. But these two lines essentially tell you that, you know, if you have in all the cubes of G by Li, if there exists another literal LK common to all these cubes, such that K is less than or equal to I, in other words, K would have already been visited, you continue. Essentially, what this is telling you is that if you, suppose you have an expression with a, as a function of number of variables, let's say A, B, C, D, E. At some point in time, if you've already considered A, B as a co-kernel, and later on, you're trying to consider B, A as a co-kernel, that is a waste of time, because A, B, and B, A are the same, right? Even in the algebraic model, A, B, and B, A commutativity holds. So A, B, and B are the same. So essentially what this is telling you is that if there is a variable in all the cubes of G by Li that has already been visited before, then this combination of, you know, LK and Li would have already been explored before, and therefore you don't need to re-explore it again in this context, okay? So in a sense, what this algorithm is doing is it's recursively exploring all possible co-kernels and then dividing the expression by those co-kernels to get the corresponding kernels, right? And as I mentioned earlier, calling this initially when you make the call, to the top-level call to the function, you give the expression for which you need to compute all the kernels and give the first parameter as zero because you have not processed any variables. So we looked at one example to illustrate this algorithm. I'm going to use a different example now to illustrate it again, and also including the, we'll see how that speed-up technique works or is useful in making this process more efficient. So here we will represent the recursive call to that function, kernels function, as a tree, like a recursion tree. Okay, so that's the way we'll be visualizing the execution of that algorithm. And the expression we will be using, original function for which we need to compute all the kernels is here, right? It's a function of A, B, C, D, E, E, F, and G, right? So initially what you do is when you call the kernels function, you initially try to divide this by each of the literals, right? You have that for loop, which processes each of the literals in lexicographic order. So here we will consider the obvious order, A through G. Any order is going to work, again. So when you divide this expression by A, essentially it results in a kernel, which is this complex expression over here. So you can verify that dividing this expression by A will result in this expression. This is a kernel because it has multiple cubes, and there is no single, it is cube free. So there is no single literal across all the terms that is common to all the terms, okay? Now, what we need to do is recursively compute the kernels of this expression itself, right? This itself is a pretty complex expression, so you need to compute its kernels. And because we know that the kernels of an expression are also valid kernels for the original expression itself, right? So now, what we do is take this expression and look at all of the remaining variables to be processed. We look at the remaining variables to be processed. We've already divided the original expression by A to get this kernel. So when we make the recursive call, we would have passed the index as 1 to this recursive call. So this recursive call is only going to look at variables 2 onwards or variables B onwards, right? So now you try dividing this expression by B. It turns out that you do get a kernel, which is CD plus CE plus DE. But you can also, and then you can further divide this or call the kernel's function on this expression itself and divide this by C to get D plus E, or you can also divide it by D to get C plus E, which is a different kernel, or you can divide it by E to get C plus D. Now, based on what we've done so far, there's something I'd like you to observe, that if you look at the literals that you divide out along this recursive path of calls to this kernel's function, the conjunction of these variables is basically what gives you, or these literals is what gives you the co-kernel. So essentially, this is a kernel with a co-kernel A. This is a kernel with a co-kernel AB, which is the literals along this path. And D plus E is also a kernel of the original expression with the co-kernel ABC. Okay? So if you look at the path down from the root to this point, that gives you the, and look at the literals you've divided by along the path, that gives you the co-kernel, because effectively what you've done is, you've done it sequentially, but effectively you've divided that original expression by ABC, one at a time, okay? So, once you have looked at all the, so at this point, only C, D, and E make sense, because none of the other variables appear in this expression. So you return to the next level of the call hierarchy, and you continue, so here you tried dividing by B, and that for loop that we see for all the remaining literals will now continue. So now you'll try dividing next by C. So once you divide this expression here by C, the expression you get is down here, BD plus BE plus DEF. And this itself can further be divided by D to get the kernel D plus EF, or it can be divided by E to get the kernel B plus DF. And that is about it, because dividing it by any of the other variables will not result in a kernel. And so now you return back to this the A level, and you continue with that for loop, where you try dividing it now by literal D, which gives you the kernel shown here. And again, you take this kernel and recursively call the kernel's function and try dividing it by E and F, which will give you valid kernels. Anything else will not give you valid kernels. And you return. And again, now try starting with E, which gives you the kernel shown here. And this can be, again, recursively, you call the kernel's function. So dividing it further by F will give you another kernel CD plus G. And go back again, divide by F. Now, notice how, because of the fact that you're processing, whenever you make the recursive call, you keep track of the variables that you divided by until this point, and you only look at variables with the index greater than that. So when I'm looking at E, I will only try to divide by F and G, right? And of course, this expression, dividing it by F gives you a valid kernel, dividing by G does not, but I'll only look at two cases. So in a sense, there is more computation done to the towards the left of the tree. You can naturally see as you go towards the right of the tree, the indices or the index range that you're using in the for loop will naturally give you lesser and lesser cases to compute. Now, in addition, if you go back up, now once you're done with dividing with F, I think that's it. So you go back up, you continue with at the top level trying to divide the whole expression by B, right? Because you have the for loop at this level, which will still continue. And that gives you the kernel shown down here. Now you can further try to recursively divide this by C. And this is where that speed up technique that we talked about now gets applied. So if you divide this expression by C, the result is going to be, you see that the result is going to be AD plus AE, right? A is common to both the terms. And A has been processed before, right? Now remember, you're processing variable C, A has been processed before. So since A is common to all the terms, that's why I put A here in the parenthesis. This is the reason why you terminate the search at this point. This is not going to give you any new kernels, because anything that you find here would have already been explored down that path there. Okay? So this is where you apply the speedup technique and stop. Similarly, if you divide by D, you will again see that A is common to all the resulting terms when you divide this expression by D, because you have AC and AE, AC or A plus AE. A is common again, so you again stop. Dividing this expression by E does give you a new kernel, so you take it and move along. Now, when you go to the next higher level and divide the expression by C, immediately you will see that when you divide this top level, this whole expression by C, all the terms that contain C also contain A. Right? This contains C, but it also contains A. Similarly, the term here contains C, but also A, and the first term also contains both C and A. So when you divide the original expression by C, you will have a resulting expression, the quotient, where all the terms have the literal A, which has been processed before. So again, you stop. Okay? And so this continues further until you, at the top level loop, you processed all the variables, but you will see that as you go through the search, you'll be applying the speed up technique more and more often, and therefore the amount of actual computation time you spend will be lesser and lesser. Okay? So that's how this algorithm derives its efficiency. Any questions on how this works? Is it clear? So at the end of this, here, I'm just thinking of visualizing the call tree. Down any path of this call tree, the sequence of literals that you're divided by forms a co-kernel. And, you know, the resulting quotient with that co-kernel as a divisor gives you your kernel, corresponding kernel. Okay? So you collect all these co-kernels which correspond to the paths and the kernels corresponding to the red expressions. And that eventually is the set of kernels for the, and co-kernels for this function. So once you do that, essentially once you're done, you probably tabulate all the co-kernels and corresponding kernels in a form like this. Note that in this case, I've just shown the kernels themselves as recursively in factored form to show that relationship that, you know, each of these kernels can generate further kernels. But basically, you know, you can multiply these out to get the kernels corresponding to these co-kernels. Okay? So, yes, Asa.
In the previous slide, when you terminated the process for the branch B and C,
right,
you, what you have run, obviously they are matching with the results you obtained from the other branch, but do you include just A to be a co-kernel?
Or no. So A here does not mean that A is a co-kernel. Here, this just means, so if you go back to the pseudocode, So I'm referring to the speed-up technique shown here, where if there is a common, so you are dividing the expression that you're trying to compute kernels for, you divide it by one literal, G divided by Li, Li is literal you're considering currently, and if G divided by Li is itself an expression, if that expression has some literal Lk, where Lk has been, K is less than I, in other words, Lk has already been processed previously in this loop, right? In all the cubes, if that is present, then you don't need to continue further. You don't need to proceed further. You just continue to the next literal at this point. So that is the speed-up technique. So the Lk that I'm talking about here is, the Lk is the A. Okay. So again, if you can see that by dividing, if you divide this expression by C, you divide the original expression by B, you get this expression here. Divide this by C, you'll get AD plus AE. So A is common to both the terms. So A is that literal, common literal, because of which you apply that speed-up technique, and you know that you don't need to explore that further. Yes?
Basically, we have a set of literals, and we are choosing a subset and taking as a co-kernel and finding the kernel if it exists.
That's correct.
So there are like two co-kernel subsets if you have n literals. So this enumeration, as in, we have to enumerate for each possible co-kernel. So
That's a very good point. So this is an efficient algorithm. I mean, it avoids unnecessary work, it avoids redundant work, but the number of co-kernels possible for an expression may still be large. Your point. And that in fact just, you know, is an excellent motivation for what we're going to be talking about next. So this algorithm, given an expression, will compute all the kernels and co-kernels. But do you really want to compute all the co-kernels and co-kernels? In some cases, depends. Well, the answer is it depends. It depends on the size of the expression. So what are these expressions? Remember the context. You have a multi-level network. The expressions are only within each of the nodes. These are unlikely to be expressions with, you know, thousands or millions of literals. These expressions are typically going to be, you know, not too big, maybe tens or few tens of literals. It depends on, so you typically will not start off with a two-level representation for a function that is extremely large, and then try to extract a multi-level, right? You start off with a Boolean network where you inherently already have some handle on the sizes of these different expressions. Now, to create further scope for optimization, as we will see later on, sometimes you intentionally collapse some of these nodes into each other to create larger expressions. But you have a handle on how big the expressions become, right? You decide how much you want to collapse, right? How many levels of the network you collapse. That gives you a control on the size of these expressions. So in practice, you would like to compute the kernels and co-kernels, but not do it very often. Right? So you can still have a large number of, for complex expressions as we are seeing here, you can still have a large number of kernels and co-kernels. And we will see how we further address that by, you know, because the naive procedure for using kernels and co-kernels to do extraction of common factors is going to be, I have a Boolean network, I'll compute kernels and co-kernels of all my nodes, and then I'll identify common factors. Now my network has changed. Oh, I need to go back and compute kernels and co-kernels again. Right? So we will, and that can be pretty expensive if you start putting this into a loop. So we'll look at approaches or efficient techniques to sort to address that problem. Okay. But that's a good observation. Any other questions or comments? Okay. If not, what we are really after is, okay, kernels and co-kernels are good, but what we are really after is how do you find common factors? Because that's the fundamental core operation that allows you to make a multi-level network more efficient. You're finding opportunities to share logic or share transistors between different nodes in the network, right? So how do you find common factors using kernels? Well, it turns out, as we already saw that from the Brayton-McMillan theorem, that If you're looking for multi-cube common factors, if you're looking for common factors that have two or more cubes, they correspond to nothing but the intersections of the kernels of the different expressions in the network, corresponding to the different nodes of the network. So intersections of kernels are going to give you common multi-cube factors. It turns out that common single-cube factors, which is, you know, the other case, is actually nothing but the intersection of co-kernels. Okay? So computing kernels and co-kernels will help you identify common factors by just looking at intersections of kernels and intersections of co-kernels. But we need to do this in a sort of efficient manner, right? So what we'll be looking at next is basically how single cube and multi-cube factors can be extracted using the concepts of kernels and co-kernels, but doing it in an efficient way to avoid the problem, for instance, of having to repeatedly run that recursive algorithm and repeatedly compute kernels and co-kernels for different nodes in the network. Okay? And more details of this are, you know, the discussion in here is going to be self-contained, but in case you're interested in details, you can find details in the paper that talks about MIS. Okay, so the extraction problem, let's just briefly restate it. Given a Boolean network, identify sub-expressions that are common to at least two of the nodes, which can be used to as common factors to reduce the number of literals of the network. Right? That's what we're trying to do. Okay, so here's an example. Network with three nodes, F1, F2, and F3. These are the three expressions inside the three nodes. And we would like to identify, in this case, one of the common factors you can identify is A plus B. So we create a new node, F4, and call its output Y4. So F4 equals A plus B, and the output of F4, which is Y4, gets substituted into the nodes from which this common factor is derived. So we can see that F1 and F2 both have A plus B as a common factor. So you have Y4 CD, and Y4 E prime in this case, okay? And from a network structure point of view, you're going from a network that looks like this to a network that looks like this, okay? So what happens, and you can repeat this process. This is not just one time. So you can look for more common opportunities for common factors. In this case, we found a multi-cube common factor. Now, if you look at it, I don't believe that there's any more multi-cube common factors you can find across multiple expressions here, but you can find a single cube common factor. CD is that single cube common factor that you extract and create yet another node, F5, with an output corresponding output called Y5. F5 equals CD, and Y5 gets substituted in place of CD wherever it was before. Right? So this is the general process that you're trying to achieve. Now, in doing this process, these steps, you would like to reduce the number of literals here in the network. Right? So if you look at the first step, how many literals do you save as a result of extracting the first common factor A plus B? You save 2 literals, right? If you count the total number of literals here and count the total number of literals here and take the difference, you'll see that you have 2 fewer literals here. Okay? Another way to quickly see that is that, you know, all the terms that are not impacted by the factoring are common in both cases, so you don't need to count them. You only count literals in the terms that are impacted, so which would be the first true terms here. So you have 6 literals, right, in A, C, D, and B, C, D, and the first 2 terms here, so you have 4 literals here. So you have 10 literals in all, right, that are, in this case, getting replaced by the terms, these terms here, right? So you have 10 literals on the originally, and now you have 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 literals, right? So you have 10 literals, you're replacing it by 7 literals, so you actually save 3 literals here, okay? Now, the second transformation, how many literals does this save? If you're in doubt, just count the literals and that, you know, that's going to be the right answer, right? You have 13 literals here, right? How many literals do you have here? Again. So this is an example of a transformation where, yes, you found a common sub-expression, but it hasn't really saved you any literals, right? So you'd like to do this only when it saves you literals. I mean, is this transformation good or not? Well, you know, it depends. I mean, maybe you can say that this is if literal count is your metric, this transformation neither hurts nor helps, okay? All right. So now we would like to to summarize, we would like to extract common factors across multiple nodes and use number of literals as the guiding metric when making that process. So the way we will do this is using a data structure, which is nothing but a matrix with zeros and ones, okay? So these 0-1 matrices, in general, I'm going to introduce 0-1 matrices as a generic data structure that can be used to represent sets, and then come back and make the connection to extraction of common factors. Because, you know, this has applications in other contexts as well. So I thought, you know, it'll be good to just talk about the general concept. So general concept is that whenever you have sets containing elements and you'd like to perform operations on those sets, 0-1 matrices are you know, a possible data structure that you need to keep in mind or consider at least. How do you encode a set membership as a zero-one matrix? Let S1 through SM be the sets, and each of these sets can have any of these elements, E1 through EN. We can construct a matrix where each set is essentially a row and each element is a column. And you have ones corresponding to the elements that belong, indicating which elements belong to each set. Right? So this is a very simple concept. So if S1 in this case consists of elements E1, E4, and E5, in the 0-1 matrix representation, S1 has entries in the corresponding columns E1, E4, and E5. And the other entries are 0, of course. Right? So this is a very straightforward representation. Why is this a useful representation? Well, what operations can you do on these matrices, on these set representations? So let's look at a rectangle in a 0-1 matrix. A rectangle is defined as a subset of rows and subset of columns such that all entries defined by the intersection of those rows and columns are all ones. For example, these are two rectangles indicated in blue and red respectively. The rectangle in blue corresponds to the rows 2 and 3 and columns 1, 2, and 3. Now, similarly, the rectangle in red corresponds to the rows 1 and 2 and columns 1 and 5. Right? So these are rectangles. Remember, the rectangles don't need to be, rows and columns do not need to be contiguous, like shown in this case. They can be anywhere. The only condition is that it's a subset of rows, subset of columns, and at all, so all I and J elements, such that I is among the set of rows, J is among the set of columns, should all be ones. Okay. Now, if you define a rectangle in a 0-1 matrix, what does the rectangle really correspond to? The intersection of these sets, right? For example, or elements common to the sets. So the rectangle in blue, for example, just tells you that S2 intersection S3, the elements common to sets S2 and S3 are E1, E2, and E3. Similarly, the red rectangle tells you that the elements common to the sets S1 and S2, that correspond to the rows, are nothing but E1 and E5. Okay? A prime rectangle is a rectangle that is not contained in any other rectangle. Right? So, for example, if you look at the rectangle consisting of rows 1 and 2 and just column 1, it is not a prime rectangle because the rectangle shown here in red is a superset. It's included in that larger rectangle. So prime rectangle is just like a prime implicant that we've talked about. It's as large as possible. It's, you know, you don't have any other valid rectangle that contains it. Okay? Are the red and blue rectangles shown here prime? Yes, they are prime, right? Because you cannot expand in any way. You cannot add any row or any column to any of these rectangles without covering at least one zero element. So these are prime rectangles. Okay? Prime rectangles in particular are going to be of interest to us. Okay, so now let's come back to applications. So how does this concept of 0-1 rectangles, 0-1 matrices and rectangles in 0-1 matrices help you to efficiently identify common factors? Okay? So there is three specific problems that I'll show can be efficiently solved using 0-1 rectangle, 0-1 matrices. One problem is the problem of identifying kernel and co-kernel pairs. Yes, we already have the recursive algorithm, but this is going to be a more efficient way of doing it. Okay. And the second problem is the problem of extracting single cube factors among multiple expressions of different nodes in a network. And the third problem is going to be extraction of multi-cube common factors. Okay. So all of these operations can just be reformulated as operations on appropriately constructed 0-1 matrices. So that is the key idea. Yes, Zohar.
No,
the concept of sparse matrix essentially arises when you look at the fraction of the entries in these matrices that are ones. So if you have a matrix that has, let's say, for example, only one in 100 entries is a one and everything else is a zero, that is known as a sparse matrix, right? So you can take this matrix and encode it as a data structure where you would not necessarily use an array to store a sparse matrix, because you'll be essentially using a lot of space to store zeros, right? So sparse matrices can be encoded more efficiently, you know, using more optimized data structures, and that's where that comes into play. So this concept itself has nothing to do with sparse matrices, right? Are the matrices, a more pertinent question would be, and maybe that's why you asked this question, is, are the matrices we are going to be dealing with, are they sparse? Possibly, but the matrices themselves, as we will see, these are not extremely large matrices. So it's, even if you are somewhat wasteful, so the degree of sparsity you know, it's not a black and white thing. There's a, you know, continuity, right? I mean, you know, is 10% of the entries being non-zero sparse? Would you consider 20%? Would you consider 1%? It's somewhat subjective, right? If, you know, you could define different thresholds that you, for the number of non-zero entries for which you consider a matrix to be sparse. But the matrices that we are going to be talking about are small enough that in practice, it may not be necessary to use sparse matrix representations. Okay. The applications, once again, are identifying kernels, single cube factors, and multi cube factors. We'll be looking at next how to use zero-one matrices to do all of these things. So how do you identify kernel-co-kernel pairs? Given a single sum of products expression, so one expression, you would like to identify all of its kernels and co-kernels. And we define the matrix, the 0-1 matrix specifically that we will construct is known as the cube literal matrix. Okay, so this is a matrix corresponding to one row for each cube of your SOP expression. So for example, if your SOP expression is as shown here, it's a function of x1 through x9, and it has 5 cubes. So corresponding to each of these cubes, you have one row labeled with the corresponding cube, and one column for each literal in this expression. So the literals here, you know, you don't have any complements, so the literals are only x1 through x9, the variables x1 through x9, so those are your 9 columns, and the 5 rows correspond to the 5 cubes. So this is known as a cube literal matrix. And here, what we are doing is, you know, to try to keep the connection with the set representation alive, that analogy alive, we are thinking of each of these cubes as nothing but sets of literals. So the ones will be, so if you have a cube x1, x2, x3, x4, x7, you know, the corresponding columns corresponding to x1, x2, x3, x4, and x7 will have 1 entries, right? So cubes are nothing but sets of literals that they contain. Now, a prime rectangle in this matrix with at least 2 rows corresponds to a kernel-co-kernel pair. Yeah. That is the statement, and let's see why that is true. For example, let's look at a couple of examples. We need 2 rows because a kernel should have at least 2 cubes. Okay, so that's the reason the 2 rows come in here. And in specifically, what does a rectangle tell you? We said a rectangle means set intersection. So if you have a rectangle, which is not trivial, it has at least 2 rows, what that tells you is that you have some literals, one or more literals, that are common to at least 2 of these cubes. So if you divide your original expression by that literal or that subset of that set of literals, then the resulting quotient will have at least 2 cubes. In other words, it is a kernel, right? Why should it be a prime rectangle? Because if the rectangle is not prime, it means either you can grow it in the row direction or in the column direction. If you can grow it in the column direction, it means that the quotient that you get is not cube free, right? So in other words, if I look at x1, x2, sure, I can divide the original function by x1, x2, and I'll get a multi-cube answer, multi-cube quotient, but that is not cube-free. It'll have x3 and x4 common to its terms. So x1, x2 is not a maximal co-kernel. You can suck in more terms to it, and you'll still get a multi-cube divisor. On the other hand, if you have a non-prime rectangle which can be grown in the column along the row dimension, it means that, you know, you can actually include another term in that kernel. So you would obviously like your kernels and co-kernels to be as large as possible in a sense, right? So for example, let's again look at these 2 examples. If you look at the blue rectangle shown here, consisting of rows 1 and 2 and columns 1 through 4, this basically tells you that the literals x1, x2, x3, and x4 are common to the first 2 cubes. So the co-kernel in this case is going to be, what is the co-kernel that this represents, this rectangle represents? It represents a kernel-co-kernel pair. The co-kernel is x1, x2, x3, x4, right? And the kernel is, of course, what results from the original expression when you divide it by x1, x2, x3, x4. That is, but you know that only the first 2 cubes matter, so it is x7 plus x8 would be your kernel, right? So a prime rectangle in this cube literal matrix is exactly equivalent to a kernel-co-kernel pair of the original expression, right? Look at the red example, the red rectangle as another example. This corresponds to the columns 1, 2, 3, rows 1, 2, 3, 4. So here the co-kernel is again x1, x2, x3. And if you look at the rectangle, what it's telling you is that x1, x2, x3, that expression is common to the first 4 cubes of your original expression. So when you extract it out, the kernel is going to be just what remains in these four cubes, right? So it's going to be x4, x7, plus x4, x8, plus x5, plus x6. That is going to be the kernel here, right? The second case. And the co-kernel is x1, x2, x3. So is that clear? Concept of why the concept of rectangles and 0-1 matrix is useful? Well, this is one of the reasons. If you construct the cube literal matrix, which is one kind of 0-1 matrix, and compute prime rectangles in the cube literal matrix, that gives you kernel co-kernel pairs. Now, this actually changes the game a little bit, because you can have this matrix and you don't need to compute all the kernel and co-kernel pairs. You can, in a sense, you can compute kernels on demand. Okay? But in order to compute kernels on demand, what are the kernels or co-kernels of interest to you? They are the ones that have common, that are common across multiple functions. So one approach, there's multiple ways to do it, but one approach is that if you have two expressions, you can take the cube literal matrices of the two expressions and see if you are able to find prime rectangles which in both which have the same, which correspond to the same set of columns, right? And they will tell you that you have the same single cube factors, right? So you can essentially identify, so one possibility is by enumerating all the prime rectangles in this matrix, you can generate all the kernel co-kernel pairs, or you can do it on demand whenever needed. Okay, so this is the first application of 0-1 matrices. And let's move on. Let's see how you actually extract single cube factors. So given a set of SOP expressions, now just you need common factors across multiple expressions. So you have a bunch of these expressions. We construct the cube literal matrix like before, except that now you have cubes and literals from all the expressions that you're considering at the same time. So this is one combined cube literal matrix, not a separate one for each. So the rows, as usual, are cubes, columns are literals, except that, you know, you have some rows corresponding, in this case, to the expression F1, some more rows corresponding to F2, and one row corresponding to F3. So that example here, we have three expressions, so you have three sort of submatrices. In a sense, you're vertically stacking up the cube literal matrices of the individual ones, okay? So this is your combined cube literal matrix. The columns, of course, are the, you know, union of all the variables that appear or literals that appear in all these expressions, right? So with this combined cube literal matrix, now we make the assertion that rectangles in this matrix correspond to single cube factors, okay? Why is that so? And more so, prime rectangles correspond to maximal or single cube factors that are as large as possible. For example, again, two prime rectangles shown here in red and blue respectively. If you look at the rectangle in red, it corresponds to rows 1 and 3, columns 1, 2, and 3. What that tells you is that the factor x1, x2, x3 is common to f1 and f2. Right? So that's basically what it tells you. And if you look at the, and the factor itself is x1, x2, x3. That is your common single cube factor. The blue rectangle tells you that the factor x1, x2 is common to all three expressions. So if you factor out x1, x2 from all three expressions, you know, it's basically, if, and you call that y, let's say, it'll be yx3 here, yx3 again, and yx4 here, right? So x1, x2 is common to all of these three. So again, prime rectangles in this combined cube literal matrix actually give you single cube factors. So you can directly identify single cube factors in this way, right? Using the cube literal matrix. Okay. We'll see, you know, again, there's many possible factors. Here we showed an example of two possible factors. For any given cube literal matrix, there's many possibilities. So we will need some metric to guide us to choose the best one at any time. We'll come back and talk about that. For now, let's look at the top level concept similarly of how you do multi-cube factors. Again, you know, with the same basic concept of 0-1 matrices. So in this case, it's a little more complex. You still use 0-1 matrices, but the matrix you construct is a little different. So far, we've constructed the matrix called cube literal matrix, right? Rows are cubes, columns are literals. Now the matrix we'll construct is a different matrix. First, you need to compute the set of kernels and co-kernels for each expression, in this case, okay? And once you do that, you construct a matrix known as the co-kernel cube matrix. So here, the rows are co-kernels, okay? And the columns correspond to cubes of kernels, unique cubes of kernels. Okay. What do I mean by that? Well, we'll look at an example in the next slide, but the idea is once you construct this matrix, again, looking at prime rectangles in this matrix is what you're looking for, and that gives you multi-cube factors. So the common theme here is that you have 0-1 rectangles, you're looking for 0-1 matrices, you're looking for prime rectangles. Depending on the matrix you use, whether it's the cube-literal matrix for a single function, cube-literal matrix of multiple expressions, or the co-kernel cube matrix, the interpretation, the semantic interpretation of that operation of rectangles, finding rectangles is going to be different. In this case, it's going to correspond to multi-cube factors. Let's look at why that is the case or how that is the case. So here's an example of three expressions, F, G, and H. And we have computed the kernels and co-kernels, the kernel-co-kernel pairs for each of these expressions that are listed out here on the left-hand side. Having computed the kernels and co-kernels, then we construct the co-kernel cube matrix where the rows correspond to co-kernels. So if you'll see the first six rows correspond to co-kernels of F. So you look at co-kernel of F, could be A, it could be B, it could be D, E, F, C, and G. So we've listed them in that same order. The corresponding kernels, we break them down into their cubes. So in this case, D, E plus F plus G has three cubes, D, E, F, and G. And so we'll make those cubes the columns here. Okay? And so you'll see that the correspondence between co-kernels and kernels are indicated by the one entries. So for F, with co-kernel A, the kernel is D plus F plus G. Therefore, you have one in the columns D, E, F, and G, respectively. Right? So this matrix captures the relationship between kernels and co-kernels for each of these functions. Similarly, for G and H. Okay? And in this case, I've just omitted the zero entries to make this less cluttered. I've just replaced them by dots. So a dot is basically a zero entry. Only the one entries are important to us anyway. Now, one thing to note is when constructing this matrix, co-kernels are not merged. In other words, if you have the same co-kernel for two different functions, you keep two distinct rows for it. For example, F has a co-kernel B, G also has a co-kernel B, but we keep them as separate rows. Similarly, F has DE, H has DE, but we keep them as separate rows. However, on the column dimension, you keep only unique, only one column per unique kernel cube. In other words, if A appears here and A appears here, you don't have two different A columns here. You only have one A column. Okay. So this is the co-kernel cube matrix. Now, if you look at a if you look at prime rectangle in this matrix, for example, I'm showing one prime rectangle here, which corresponds to columns 3, 4, 9, and, rows 3, 4, 9, and 10, and columns 1 and 2. What does this rectangle correspond to? What this is telling you is that you have A plus B, which is, either a kernel of this or some subset of a kernel of F, and similarly of G, having these respective co-kernels. So in other words, if you have at least a rectangle with at least two columns, it tells you that you have a kernel intersection of a kernel from F and kernel from G that has at least two cubes. Remember, kernel intersections are exactly what we are looking for as our multi-cube factors. Right? Intersections of kernels where you have common cubes between kernels. For example, you have A plus B here and A plus B here. So that's an example of, A is common, B is common. So you have a kernel intersection of two cubes. So you're looking for kernel intersections of at least two or more cubes. Right? So if you compute prime rectangles and they correspond to rectangles with at least two columns, that is going to tell you that you have these multi-cube common factors. In fact, you can directly from the rectangle itself, you can correspondingly look at the network level view and see what the common multi-cube factor is. Here, the multi-cube factor is nothing but A plus B because the columns are A and B, labeled A and B respectively. And furthermore, because of where you have ones or the correspondences between the rows and columns, you can also see that the way the network will be transformed is that you will have DE and F to be the terms that are multiplied with the output of this common factor, in this case X, in F. And similarly in G, you have the co-kernels CE and F, which will be multiplied by X, okay, in the transformed network. So hopefully it is apparent from here that rectangles again correspond to common multi-cube factors. Of course, with the condition being that the rectangle has to involve rows across multiple functions, only then you're actually extracting a factor from multiple functions, and it has to have at least two columns because it has to be a multi-cube factor. Okay. So if those conditions are satisfied, then you have a valid multi-cube factor. Okay. So far is the concept clear? Zero on matrices, depending on how you formulate the matrix, you can use it either to just identify kernels, co-kernels, or identify single cube common factors or multi-cube common factors. So the question I have for you is, how does this really relate to the Brayton-McMillan? Can we restate the Brayton-McMillan theorem on multi-cube factors using the zero-on matrix? And I, you know, actually just mentioned, I literally gave away the answer a few seconds back. So remember, the Brayton-McMillan theorem says, given two expressions, they have multi-cube common factors if and only if there exists a pair of kernels of each of these expressions that have an intersection of cardinality greater than one. Right? So how would you restate that same theorem in terms of the 0-1 matrices, in terms of the co-kernel cube matrix, to be precise? So, you know, I'll start it off for you. Given two expressions, there exist multi-cube factors if and only if the co-kernel cube matrix of these expressions has a dash. It needs to have a rectangle. What sort of rectangle? Okay. What property should that rectangle have? What additional properties should the prime rectangle have? It should have at least two columns. That assures you that the factor will be a multi-cube factor. And what tells you that it's common to two functions? It should involve rows from at least two functions, right? So it should involve the co-kernels of at least two functions, and it should involve at least two columns, right? In fact, even primality is not necessary. If you have any rectangle that satisfies those properties, then it tells you that you have a multi-cube factor. You might as well go for the prime rectangle, because when you're extracting a factor, you want to extract something that's as big as possible. That's all, right? So if you could extract a factor with three terms, why would you do only one with two terms? And that is sort of the intuition as to why you want prime rectangles. But if you look at the existential, you know, theorem, as long as you have two columns and the rows involving at least two functions, then it tells you that you have a multi-cube factor that you can extract. Okay. So with this basic background, we can now rethink the way we are doing factoring, right? Purely based on these 0-1 matrix representations of the Boolean network. So you can take your entire Boolean network, if you wish, or any subset of it, and represent it as this matrix, and use the operations on the matrix, basically rectangle identification, as your core operation to be able to do factoring on the network. So the general idea of how to do this in practice, because again, the number of prime rectangles can actually be quite large, right, in any of these matrices, whether it be the cube little matrix or the co-kernel cube matrix. The general idea is that you iteratively find rectangles in these cube literal and co-kernel cube matrices, guided by a certain metric. You need a metric to tell you which is the best rectangle at any time. So you find a rectangle, you accept it, you say, is this going to lead to a reduction in the literals in my network? And say that, okay, I'm going to accept this as my common factor. And then you need to do something to the matrix to reflect the fact that you now changed the network. And then you need to keep proceeding, right? So the real issues you need to solve is, which factor at any point do you pick? And what do you do once you pick a factor? Because now the network has changed. So how do you, ideally, you'd like to keep all of your operations purely in the matrix domain. You don't want to keep going back and forth between network and matrix, because that conversion is expensive. So ideally, if you can reformulate everything, all that you want to do purely in terms of the 0-1 matrix, then you have a potential to do this whole thing efficiently, right? So what are the operations you need to do on the 0-1 matrix? You need to identify rectangles, and you need to specifically identify which rectangle to pick or which factor to pick at any given point, and then how do I update this matrix directly once I've picked a factor? So you can do this one at a time, or an interesting alternative, even though this is not actually done, I believe in SIS or MIS, is that you could, at any time, this is also a sort of covering problem, right? Because in a sense, what you're trying to do is that you're trying to start with this matrix, and you're trying to find common factors as much as possible. So in a sense, you're trying to cover this matrix as much as possible with common factors. So you could use an espresso-like algorithm, if you wish, to also do a covering on that matrix as well. But, you know, that's just a thought. In practice, you know, this is done more one at a time. Okay, so the two issues we're going to be discussing further are how do you select factors and what do you do once you select a factor to the matrix. So we've already said the metric that we're going to be using is literal count. So in this entire process of factoring the network, I'd like to start off with a network and end up with a network that is has as few literals as possible. Right. So what you need, at any given point in time, you have a network and you have multiple possible rectangles that you could choose as common factors, right? So you need to be able to compute, given a rectangle, how many literals would I save if I were to extract the factor corresponding to this rectangle? Right? And ideally, you'd like to do that without going and changing the Boolean network and the expressions themselves. I mean, the trivial way to do it is to go back to the network, actually do the factoring, count literals, okay? But you'd like to do this efficiently without, you know, making all of those changes. Right? So how many literals would I save if this factor corresponding to the rectangle is extracted as a new node and substituted in all the nodes for that the factor came from? In order to do that, we define a metric known as the value of a prime rectangle or value of a rectangle in general in the 0-1 matrix. It's basically, it's an estimate of the improvement in the Boolean network that will result, improvement in literal count, that will result when you factor out the term corresponding to the rectangle. So the question is, how can you compute this value easily from the rectangle itself without looking at the expressions and counting literals? So in order to see how you do that, we will look at, first we look at the single cube case, and then we look at the multi-cube case. So in the single cube case, remember that the matrix that you're looking at is the, what is this called? Cube literal matrix, right? So you have cubes of the expressions here as the rows, and literals among from the expressions as the columns. So this is the matrix you use to identify single cube factors. We define the weight of a row of this cube literal matrix to just be one for each row. So each row is said to have a weight of one. Each column is also said to have a weight of one. Okay. We'll see why we are defining weights in this manner. It should become apparent when we put everything together and compute the value. But the weight of a row is defined as one. Weight of a column is defined as one. The weight of a rectangle is defined as nothing but the sum of the row weights and sum of the column weights. If you have a rectangle with just one row, it is nothing but just the sum of the column weights. But if you have a number of rows and columns, it is the column weights plus row weights. And of course, given the fact that the rows and columns each have a weight of one, this is nothing but just counting the rows and columns, right? So for a rectangle, so for the blue rectangle, for example, has two columns and three rows, so its weight is five. The red rectangle has two rows and three columns. Again, the weight is five. So now, given the weight of a rectangle defined as in that manner, we compute the value of the rectangle in the cube literal matrix as follows. The value of an element of the cube literal matrix is nothing but the element itself. So if you have a 1 entry, the element has a value of 1. If you have a 0 entry, the element has a value of 0. And the value of a rectangle is defined as the sum of the element values minus the weight of the rectangle. So in other words, we are counting the ones in the rectangle minus the number of rows plus number of columns. Okay? So that is how we define the value of the rectangle in the cube literal matrix case. Right? As I said, it's the number of ones covered by the rectangle minus the number of rows plus the number of columns. So in this case, if you look at the example shown here, what is the weight of the rectangle? 5, because you have, you know, 3 rows and 2 columns, 3 plus 2, 5. What is the value of the rectangle? 1, because its number of elements is 6. 6 minus 5 is 1, right? So value of the rectangle is 1. Now, why do we define value in this manner? Why does this make sense? Now, let's go back. It's the same rectangle I'm showing here, except now I'm also giving you the original network that this rectangle was generated from, set of three expressions that correspond to the cubes here, and of course the literals as the columns. And I'm showing you this rectangle corresponds to the single cube factor AB. I'm also showing you the network that will result after you extract that single cube factor out here, x equals AB, and it's substituted in F and G. So what is the, let's count literals in the before and after networks and look at the difference. So how many literals do you have before? 16, right? how many literals do you have after? So you have 16, start with the network with 16 literals and end up with a network with? You need, remember, you need to count this too. You've added a node. 15 literals, right? If you go through and just count all appearances of variables on the right-hand side of these equations in all the nodes, just sum it up. That's what literal count is, right? So you start off the network with 16 literals, you end up with the network with 15 literals, and the change in literals is 1. The value of the rectangle we also computed to be was to be 1. Is it a coincidence or is there a correlation between the two? Is it just completely by chance that they're the same? Or is this just a different way of calculating that? Of course, I wouldn't put them on the slide if it were just by chance, right? So there has to be a correlation. Why is this the same as that? What are you doing when you compute the change in literals? You look at the before literals minus the after literals, right? So what is, if you come back now and look at the entries of the rectangle, what does that mean? What does the number of entries of the rectangle mean? It is the number of literals in the expressions here that are going to be impacted through the factorization. Right? Why? Because when you extract AB from the expression ABC, the two literals AB here disappear. They're no longer there. You don't see AB here anymore. So you're removing AB from the literal count. Similarly, ABC also appears in ABD. AB also appears in ABD. So again, you remove AB from the second term. AB no longer appears here, right? So the number of elements here corresponds to the number of literals that are actually going to be removed from the expression on the left. And the weight of the rectangle corresponds to the number of new literals that are added on the right. That's why you need to take the value of the number of elements minus the number of rows and columns. The number of columns is nothing but the number of literals here in this new node. The number of rows is the number of times the output of this new node appears in those expressions, has to be substituted. So you need to count that too. Right? So that's why the number of rows and columns, in a sense, gives you the after picture. The number of literals after, the number of elements in the rectangle gives you the number of literals before. Before minus after is nothing but literal savings. So this is nothing but another way of computing the number of the literals saved in the network without actually going back to the network and making the change. Okay? So why is this useful? Well, it's useful because just by looking at the 0-1 matrix, you're able to compute literal counts and literal savings. And that's great. Now you can formulate a nice optimization problem. Give me the rectangle with the highest value. Right? Solve it exactly or heuristically, it's up to you, but at least the problem is well defined now. Give me the rectangle with the highest value, I can compute the value just by looking at this data structure itself. So it's a self-contained problem definition on the 0-1 matrix. Is that clear? For the single cube case, we have not talked about the multi-cube case yet, but this is just the single cube case. This might be a good point to stop. Well, let me see if I can cover the multi-cube case in a few minutes, and then we'll stop after that. So what happens when you have multi-cube factors? Well, first of all, the matrix that you use is different. Remember, the matrix that you use is now called the co-kernel cube matrix, right? The co-kernels are in the rows, cubes of kernels are in the columns, okay? And again, you have, normally you have 0-1 entries, but in this case, I've actually replaced the 1 entries. 0 entries are just omitted here. I've replaced the 1 entries by the conjunction of the co-kernel and the kernel cube. So I have DE here and A here, so it's ADE here. Okay, so we'll see in a minute why I do that. But for now, just think of these as all the 1 entries, okay? So this is a co-kernel cube matrix for a set of functions, 3, F, G, and H. Again, we define the weight. Now it will be apparent as to why we define the weight and value the way we did for the single cube case. The same analogous definition will be provided for the multi-cube case, so that value will eventually be computed in the same way for both these matrices. Okay? So we define the weight of the column of the co-kernel cube matrix as nothing but the, remember the columns, what do the columns correspond to? Cubes of kernels, right? So each of these cubes has some number of literals. So this has one literal, one literal, one literal, two literals, and the last two have one literal each. So the weight of a column is nothing but the number of literals in the label of the column. The weight of a row is the number of literals in that row label, that is in the co-kernel, plus one. Okay, so again, the reason for the plus one will become apparent when we put it all together. But for now, just say the weight of a column is just the number of literals in the column label. Weight of the row is number of literals in the row label plus one. The value of an element of the co-kernel cube matrix is defined as if that element has a zero, of course, the value is zero. If the element has a one, it's the number of literals that you get by taking the product of the row and the column. So in other words, number of literals in the row plus number of literals in the column, right? And that's why I have all the labels here, so that you can easily compute the element values for the one elements. So that this element has a value of 3, this element has a value of 2, and so on. Okay. So now, with that definition of weight of rows and columns and value of elements, everything else is the same as a single cube case. The weight of the rectangle is nothing but the sigma of the row weights plus sigma of column weights. The value of a rectangle is sum of the element values minus the weight of the rectangle, which is sigma row weights plus sigma column weights. And the interpretation is exactly the same. The value, again, as we will see, will tell you how many literals are saved if you extract this multi-cube factor out of the network. Okay? So let's look at an example here and again reaffirm that, you know, that intuition. So if you look at what are the column weights here? Column weights are 1 and 1. The row weights are 3, 2, 3, and 2. So what is the weight of the rectangle? Sigma of row weights plus sigma of column weights. 1 plus 1, 2. Plus 3, 5. 7, 10, 12. Right? So the weight of this rectangle is 12. What is the value of the rectangle? Value of the rectangle is the sum of the element values minus the rectangle weight. Right? What is the sum of the element values? 3, right? This element has a value of 3. This element also has a value of 3. So 3 plus 3 is 6. This element has a value of 2. So that makes 8. This one has a value of 2. That makes 10. 13. 16. 18. And 20. So the value of the rectangle is 20 minus 12, which is 8. Okay? This is the sum of the element values. This is the weight that we've computed before. And the difference gives you the value of the rectangle. So the value of this rectangle is 8. Now, if you go back to the network view, these are the expressions corresponding to the three nodes in the network. And the common factor in this case, as you can see from the columns, is A plus B. And when you substitute the common factor back, you get these expressions, modified expressions. Let's count literals before and after. How many literals do you have before? 33. Okay, you got a head start, looks like. That was quick. 33. How many do you have after? 25. Must be 25, but, you know, let's just confirm that it is 25, right? Is it 25? Yes. It is 25, right? Okay, somebody's counted it as 25. So 33 minus 25 is 8. So again, the value of the rectangle happens to match the change in the number of literals. Now again, let's justify why that's the case, and then we're done for today. So why is this the case? Why is computing the value of the rectangle in this manner giving you the exact change in number of literals? Again, it's literals before minus literals after. That's what we're trying to do. Okay? So sum of the element values. What are the element values here? The element values correspond to the terms of your original expressions that are getting changed. Right? So originally you had ADE, and that corresponds to an element here, ADE. Right, the elements of your original SOP expressions that are being impacted by the factoring directly correspond to the elements of the rectangle. So you have 8 elements in this rectangle, and you will see here that 8 elements are of your 8 product terms from your original expressions have been impacted. Right, they are ADE, BDE, AF, and BF from this first expression, and ACE, BCE, AF, and BF from the second expression. So if you count the literals of those original terms minus the literals of these new terms, of course you have to add this as well, minus the new literals, that gives you the literal savings, right? So the sum of the element values is nothing but the number of literals in those original terms. And how about the weight? So we have the before part, which matches. How about the weight? The weight, remember, the weight is nothing but, first you compute the sum of the literals in the columns, and that tells you exactly how many literals you have in this node. Right? And then, why do you compute 1 plus the number of literals in the rows? Because the number of literals in the rows are the corresponding, the remaining literals that will remain in each of those original terms that have been factored out, plus you have one literal representing the output of the new node that you put in. So that's where the plus 1 comes from. So in other words, the weight of this rectangle is nothing but the after number of literals in these the new terms that are replacing those terms that have been impacted. So the before minus after, again, of course, unsurprisingly gives you the change in the number of literals. Okay. So the key insight, you know, that I'd like to leave you with is 0-1 matrices now are a very promising way to perform factoring, because at least we've shown that we can compute literal savings, we can identify factors directly on the 0-1 matrix, we can compute literal savings on the 0-1 matrices. What we've not seen is that you need to do a sequence of operations, of factoring operations, so you need to update these matrices so that the next operation is going to be correct, and that we're going to be talking about in the next lecture, how to do that. Any questions? Okay. No, thanks.